Estate v. Kozinski, 00-2545 Sierra. James Bullen is moving to the podium. He's assistant to state public defender. Mr. Bullen, you have 25 minutes and 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name again is Jim Fullen. I'm an assistant state public defender, and I'm representing John T. Kozinski, Jr. this morning. In Bangert, Chief Justice Cece's opinion for the majority, there was a concurrence as well, notes that one purpose of a plea colloquy is to alert the accused to the possibility that a lawyer may discover defenses or mitigating circumstances which would not be apparent to a layman such as the accused. When I saw the pictures that Mr. Kozinski showed to Jill L., I certainly was curious about whether his trial counsel had advised him that he might have a defense based on her age. Perhaps some of you have examined the record and formed your own impressions of whether that those photos are appropriate or inappropriate for a 17-year-old. If you haven't, I invite you to do so. When Mr. Kozinski told me that counsel had not discussed the definition of harmful to minors with him and had not advised him that the jury would be instructed to consider Jill L.'s age, I knew that we had a Bangert issue, because neither the plea colloquy nor the plea questionnaire explained that mere depictions of nudity are not necessarily obscene, even for minors. And under your decision in Thiel, 183 Wis. 2nd, the jury will be instructed to determine the value of allegedly harmful material by reference to what a reasonable minor of like age would consider artistic, political, scientific, educational, and so on. Even before Bangert, it was the law of Wisconsin that a plea that was not entered with an understanding of the nature of the offense was not entered knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently, and may be withdrawn under the manifest injustice standard.
Mr. Fullen, what bothers me about this is how much does the judge have to tell the defendant? Now, I read the colloquy that appears in, I think it's one of these appendices, and he is told that the material was harmful. That's one of the elements, right?
Yes.
And he's told that we're talking about someone who's not 18, right?
Yes.
Now, there could be any number of aspects of material not harmful. Could be aspects about transferring. Remember, in the 15-year-old, which was a dropped charge, he didn't transfer it directly, right?
So it could have. He denies that he did. Yes.
Okay, but let's suppose he didn't. But you could have, that may be a problem. The jury might be told if that was a, that was one of the offenses. What I'm getting at is the judge, in making this colloquy, doesn't know all the aspects that might come up in a trial, and therefore can't say, well, you know, it's transferred directly or indirectly, and indirectly may be good enough if, but not good enough if. So what do you expect the judge to do? I mean, you've got counsel in here. The judge can lay this out. You've got a plea waiver questionnaire. Why aren't you going in on ineffective assistance of counsel?
I think we made a prima facie case, and it's not my habit to call counsel ineffective, because I think a prima facie case was made, and it was the state's burden. At that point, the burden shifted to the state to call his counsel and ask him what he told him. Bangert itself gives trial courts great flexibility in conducting plea colloquies.
Mr. Fullen, how do you feel that you established a prima facie case when you've got a situation, as the chief has pointed out, where you've got a colloquy with the judge, the judge goes over the elements of the offense, you've also got a plea questionnaire and waiver of rights form, the plea questionnaire makes it clear what the elements of the offense are. How did the defendant establish a prima facie case? I don't understand your argument.
Well, it depends on what's an element. I think an element is something that the jury will have to find beyond a reasonable doubt for him to be convicted. And one of the things that this jury would have to find, if he had a jury, was that this material was harmful. And harmful is defined right in the statute, right in the jury instructions. It's all set forth there.
In the first instance, what you seem to be saying is that the judge didn't do his job here because the judge talked about the elements of the offense but didn't explain them at great length. Where in Bangert or any of the other cases you cite is there such a requirement?
Well, Bangert suggests that trial courts have a variety of ways. They can read the jury instructions. They can ask the trial counsel whether he explained the elements. They can refer to other portions of the record that demonstrate the defendant knew what he was doing. They can refer to, this is all in Bangert. Please look at it, because we should be past this.
I've read Bangert, and
all right.
Bangert doesn't say you have to do all of those.
No, you don't have to do any. There any way, but nowhere on the record of this case is there any suggestion based on anything that Mr. Trochinski understood what harmful to children means. And in fact, when we had the Bangert hearing, he testified that he didn't understand, that his trial counsel never explained it. If he had understood, he would not have pled guilty, because he could have, and says he would have, asked the jury to consider whether the material was appropriate for a 17-year-old girl. And that is something which, if he had requested it under Thiel, they would have been told. You know, I read this, and, you know, there was a colloquy, there was a plea questionnaire, but there was, like, no going into the defense that Mr. Trochinski told me he wanted to and would have raised if he'd known it was available.
Let me ask you this. Just what you're asking is that, in basically saying that Judge Murak did not read, and he would have had to read the jury instruction. That's what you're saying should have been done. So each time, what concerns me is that, and I can say, having been a trial judge, that this is, once this court makes a pronouncement, if that's what you want, and we say, well, the judge should have read what is harmful to a child, then that is the clarion call. So if we would say that, the next step would be, well, the judge should have read this instruction or that. And I'm just imagining what do you have to say about that?
Well, we could just have asked Mr. Trochinski's lawyer, did you go over with him these jury instructions that would have been given? And, but this never happened. There's no indication on the record. Mr. Trochinski alleged that it didn't happen. Mr. Trochinski testified that it didn't happen. The state could have called Mr. Trochinski's lawyer if... You know, but it was ruled that this was fine, and this wasn't a prima facie case, and therefore we don't really care whether Trochinski understood that he had any facts.
I think we care. The problem that I see is that if the court were to adopt your position, then I think that it would make a substantial difference that the court would then go through the jury instructions, because this is, in the Trochinski case, this is what happened there. And the court required, this court required that the trial court would go through that and should have been more exploratory and more fully have explained to the defendant. So what you're saying, it's not just the minimal requirement, I understand that, but in order to fulfill what you're asking, the judge would have had to, and should have, perhaps, gone into this and then asked those questions. What differentiates that from any other case where the court goes through a Bangert hearing and then has to explain, or should explain, now you understand and go through the jury instructions?
Well, if you want to put it off on trial counsel, well, Judge Murrah could have just asked trial counsel whether he explained what this offense is about. Because I don't believe that Mr. Toczynski knew what this case was about. He had a defense he didn't know about it, that no one told him about. And I think this court should just, you know, read this record and determine on your own whether this was an adequate colloquy. Or, if it wasn't, whether the state stepped up and bore its burden. It's not that hard to do. You know, it's not on the record, but his trial counsel was there on the day of the Bangert hearing. All the DA would have had to do was call him to the stand and make a record that the guy understood it. But instead of that, they decided to just say, well, this was good enough. Now, why can't this court focus, as I believe this court did when it wrote Bangert, on whether he really knew it? You know, I don't think it's going to take a long time. If they stapled the jury instructions onto the plea questionnaire, we wouldn't be here.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. Now, the plea questionnaire says, I fully understand the following constitutional rights and give them up of my own free will. My right to make the state prove me guilty of each element of the offense beyond a reasonable doubt. The state will only have to show that there are facts sufficient to support the charges, even if I disagree with those facts. And it's signed by, as you very well know, the defendant, that I fully understand the document. I've answered all the questions. I'm freely giving up my constitutional rights. I'm mentally alert. The attorney's statement says, I have discussed the document with the defendant. I believe the defendant understands this document and the plea agreement and is making the plea freely and intelligently and voluntarily. I am aware of my duty to represent the defendant in any post-conviction relief until I am or another attorney is retained or appointed. And I saw the defendant sign it. Now, I favor, and I think the law requires in this state that you do have it on the record and not rely solely on counsel. I agree with you, counsel. On the other hand, aside from attaching all of the jury instructions that are applicable in the case, I don't see what the judge can do when the judge making sure about the understanding of the defendant. I just don't think the judge can go into every possible way the defendant might get out, and that every possible defense that the defendant might use that a jury would accept.
Well, I don't think so either, Your Honor. But I think in this case, because of the nature of this offense, this definition is an element. It wasn't listed on the plea questionnaire as an element. It wasn't covered in the plea colloquy as an element. But I've argued, and I believe, that it is an element. It's an element because it's something that the jury is going to have to find to convict them. Now, what other definition of an element is there other than a fact that the jury... This is not some unusual, extraneous, you know, defense that could hypothetically exist. This is a crime. And it's not a crime to convey a picture of a naked man unless it's harmful.
Okay, now we're getting to the crux of it. I read your position, Mr. Fullen, far more narrowly than you have initially articulated it here at oral argument. I don't read your position as asking for a new rule for plea colloquies across the board, in that judges will henceforward have to go over with defendants all the defenses that might potentially be applicable to the charged crime, all of the legal definitions that are applicable to each element of the offense, or anything of that nature. I understood your position to be that because this is a variable obscenity statute and First Amendment rights are implicated and the legal standard or legal definition that applies to the determination of what is harmful to children separates not only legal conduct from illegal conduct, but protected conduct from unprotected conduct, that this colloquy failed, or at least the burden shifted to the state to
right.
show the defendant's
understanding. That's exactly what I'm trying to say. I do not want to be standing here saying you gotta read the jury instructions, you gotta staple the jury instructions. I don't want to say any of that because we have a flexible rule, which trial courts comply with every day in hundreds and hundreds of cases. But in this case, this man didn't understand that what this crime was, and that even though the girl wasn't 18, he might have had a jury defense at least, because the definition right in the statute, right in the jury instructions, raises that issue. And if he had understood it, he says, he wouldn't have pled. He would have taken his chance with the Washoe County jury on whether 17 and a half, this isn't really harmful at that age. It's a variable obscenity statute. And I really totally agree with you, Justice Sykes. I'm not trying to propose some rule that we can now do that and we're always covered. That isn't any good either. You've got to be flexible, and in a case where it's important that the defendant understand not only that minor means under 18, but also that mere nudity isn't enough. It has to be beyond mere nudity. Everyone knew these were pictures of himself nude. That's not it. There were other elements that the state would have had to prove to find him guilty, and he wouldn't have pled if he'd understood that. And there's no evidence in the record that he did understand it. And I think, you know, that was how I saw it from day one. We're not going to come down here and argue for some inflexible rote rule, because the rote rules were followed. There was a plea questionnaire, there was a colloquy, you know, just looking at the rote rules, no violation.
So your position is that on the basis of the nature of this offense, which Justice Sykes described, it involves First Amendment considerations. On the basis of that offense, and on the basis of the facts of this case, that you're dealing with a 17-plus-year-old person, that the trial court erroneously exercised its discretion in not granting you the motion to withdraw his plea.
It erroneously decided that he hadn't made out a prima facie case on the facts of this case, right? And because then we could have called defense counsel, or the state could, I didn't think it was my job, to prove that he did understand it, notwithstanding his motion, notwithstanding the kind of...
What's the standard? Manifest justice? Is that the standard?
Manifest injustice to withdraw a plea after sentencing, but it's been clearly held that if it isn't knowing, voluntary, and intelligent, that's a basis. Before sentencing, it's a lower standard.
You're also making a facial attack on this statute. What was wrong with Kevin L.C.?
Well, what was wrong with Kevin L.C.?
You only have 20 minutes, counsel.
I'm kind of caught between still and purpose here because, you know, I think the statute needs to be, this court is unanimously held, it chills free expression. As it stands, to the extent that it's done in the mail. If he'd mailed these photos to her, he couldn't be prosecuted. Now, I've got the case where he handed them to her. Is that so different? If the statute chills free expression when he mails these pictures to her, and therefore is unconstitutional on its face, I believe on its face, I'm sure we'll hear an argument to the contrary, but again, it's up to this court, was Widener as applied, or was it on its face decision? I read it, and I thought it was on its face, that you said this statute can't stand. It impermissibly shifts burden of persuasion on the scienter as to age, you know, and chills free expression, and I think it still does. And I think the legislature is going to have to revisit that statute, and you might as well bite off the other little piece and say, even if there is face-to-face, it still chills free expression. I think this case proves it. This man's doing 6 years in prison for a crime that wouldn't have existed if he hadn't seen her. But he goes in a quick mark, she sells him some beer, he assumes she's a grown-up, he gives her the photos with a cover letter saying, don't show this to children. He's never taken the position that even these photos are appropriate for young children. I think you can provide some guidance. You know, you didn't go that far because the facts didn't require it in Widener. But in this case, I'm asking for the same finding. You know, and since you all agreed that it chills free expression, I ought to win this case. You know, okay, he came in, he saw her, he handed him to her. He had no reason to believe that she was underage. And I think a constitutional statute would have something about that in it.
It's an affirmative defense.
Pardon?
It's an affirmative defense, right?
Oh, the affirmative defense. I didn't think this court liked that. You've got to show documentary proof of age. So he goes in the quick mart. He buys the beer. They're talking about, oh, I hear you're going to be in Playgirl. And then he's thinking, well, would you like to see my pictures? Well, I don't know if she wanted to or not. But anyway, he offered them to her. First of all, he's supposed to go, do you have a draft card? You know, do you have an ID? No, I don't think so. It doesn't make any sense. You know, that this little narrow affirmative.
How do you establish, let me ask you, because you have no reason, how do you establish age when you're face to face? Is it just an observation?
I think in this case, definitely so. But
well, I'm 47, right? No, I'm just saying.
You're over 18, okay? If somebody's on the cusp, if someone's on the bubble, you got to be more careful.
But I've had a hard life. The point is, how do you establish age unless you have to, okay, you have some materials, and whether he should have shown them. What if she was obviously 4 years old, but he thought she was 18? Is it because she looked to be 4 years old?
He can try that in front of
a
jury.
No, I'm just asking.
Yeah, but, you know, the bigger the difference, the farther she is from the bubble, the easier it's going to be for the state to show that he should have known.
And particularly when you have these photos, because that tells you something in itself. He's not showing her a comic book with Superman, right?
Right.
I don't think we have to rule on that.
I'm asking. You brought up the issue of you know, he had no reason to suspect about her age, and I'm just asking, how do you determine that?
You give it to the jury. You make it an element of the offense. I don't want you to do it, but when the legislature writes the statute, they should go back to where they were before crimes against children created this ridiculous strict liability situation, because this is a First Amendment issue. You know, now he knew that these were nude pictures, you know, but whether they were inappropriate for Jill, he thought not. I think not. But he didn't know he could ask a jury that. You know, and that's the problem with this plea. And I think if she were 8, you know, then he wouldn't even try such a defense. He would know that he could never persuade a jury he thought she was 18. But the closer she gets to 18, you know, then the harder it is going to be for the state to show. But the state should have to show it. The state should bear the burden of proving scienter in an expression case, not in a sex case, not in a sexual contact case, but in an expression case, the state could bear that burden easily most of the time.
Mr. Fullen, you made a statement that I wrote down here. I want to make sure that I understand what you're saying. You said that he didn't know he could ask the jury that. And I think what you meant by that was he didn't know he could ask the jury to determine if the jury thought that these materials were harmful to Jill.
That's right.
And that he was entitled to do.
I think so. That's the first part of the brief. You know, he didn't understand that. No, maybe it's not a defense at all. Maybe if you're 17 and 358 days, it doesn't really matter. But I don't think that's the law of the state. Under Thiel, the value of these materials, their harmfulness, is determined by reference to a reasonable person of the person's age to whom the materials are demonstrated. And I don't think, he wouldn't have, you know, if this was a very young person, you can tell from the way this whole case went down that he knew this was not appropriate to give a little kid. And he wouldn't have tried to defend on that basis, you know. But he doesn't really have a defense that he didn't know she was under 18. But he did have the right to ask a jury to determine whether the materials were totally inappropriate for a 17-year-old. And he didn't think they were, and I think he's entitled to take his chances rather than plead, not knowing that.
Well, the state makes a point that count one was where a 15-year-old was involved.
That was a different count. That got dismissed. If the plea is allowed to be withdrawn, maybe they'll try to prove that one. You know, he denies that that happened. He said she looked over the shoulder of an adult, but, you know, that's for trial. I don't see how it relates to this case at all. There was a plea to a certain thing, a certain age girl, and that's what we're arguing about, not whether he maybe should have pled anyway. That's not relevant.
If you win on the second point on the constitutionality, then you don't go back for new
then
trial.
We don't go back. Then he's out of his 6-year sentence.
Whole statute is struck down.
I think it really was already, but just this court stopped a little short of face-to-face, and I'm asking it to take that next little baby step before the legislature rewrites it, because I think they probably will try.
Mr. Fullen, the photographs that were scheduled to be published in the Playground never were published, I gather.
I don't know. It's not in the record. I never went back for back issues of Playgirl, so I couldn't answer that.
All right. If they had been published and he had shown Jill Playgirl, see my picture in Playgirl, would there be any different result?
No. It would be the same. The seller of the Playgirl is protected by other Supreme Court decisions, but if he had selected a particular person and shown pictures in Playgirl rather than pictures, I think it would come down the same.
And if he had shown it to a 4-year-old, that would be a violation of the statute.
Well, yes.
You don't dispute that?
No, he wouldn't. I won't.
Thank you, Mr. Fullen. Daniel O'Brien, Assistant Attorney General of the State of Wisconsin, representing the State of Wisconsin. Mr. O'Brien.
May it please the Court. If you accept counsel's argument, then you must throw the statute out entirely. And so it is perfectly proper for Mr. Trzynski to show this picture of him standing in the nude with his penis exposed to a 4-year-old. And he has to concede that will be one of the results of this court's ruling. That is so because he is bringing a facial overbreadth challenge to the statute, not a challenge as applied to him. He can't bring a challenge as applied to him because he waived that by virtue of his voluntary and intelligent guilty plea. And so the issue before this court is whether this statute is so overbroad on balance with its plainly legitimate sweep that it creates an intolerable burden or criminalizes an intelligible range of conduct.
Mr. O'Brien, it appears to me that you're getting into that constitutional question, and I want to ask you a preliminary question. If this court were to find that the plea was invalid because it was unknowing, do we have to reach the constitutional question?
If you find that it's...
If we find that it's...
No, because I guess you could then remand for a bank. Let me backtrack. I guess since it is a First Amendment overbreadth challenge, the law of First Amendment allows a person to basically raise hypothetical constitutional challenges under the overbreadth doctrine. And so I would say, even though he has waived his as-applied challenge, and even if the court were to uphold on remand, uphold the guilty plea, if after a Bangert hearing, or, you know, he could still challenge the statute. However, I guess the other option is to withdraw the plea, let him go back to trial on both counts, and then if he's convicted, then I suppose he can challenge it at that point. So maybe that would be the cleanest way of doing that, other than, in essence, issuing an advisory opinion on the statute, because there's a chance that he could be acquitted after a trial, and the issue would never come up in this case. So I guess that would be the cleanest way, is if you allow him to withdraw, to remand for further proceedings, and if it results in an acquittal, the issue never comes up. If it results in conviction, he can then challenge the constitutionality of that statute, and perhaps then he could bring both a facial and as-applied challenge, because since the plea would be withdrawn, his waiver of the facial challenge would also be removed. And so on, yeah.
But this issue is kicking around out there in light of Wiedner, isn't it? In light of some language in Wiedner? In light of some language in the Wiedner case?
In Wiedner?
Wiedner.
Yeah. The issue is there. Well, Wiedner and Kevin L.C. and the United States Supreme Court decision in Excitement Video, yeah, the issue is live. And although this court did not directly address this issue, I think it has, in essence, at least inferentially addressed it in both Zarnke and Wiedner, and the Court of Appeals has directly addressed it in Kevin L.C. And so there's some pretty strong precedent indicating that, at least when you have a face-to-face situation where a defendant is in a position to reasonably ascertain the person's age, that the affirmative defense, the statute is constitutional, the affirmative defense is valid. But I think it's important, again, since we're dealing with overbreadth doctrine, and I know I cited the court the recent authority of the United States v. Fox, which, if I recall, was a Fifth Circuit opinion, but also this court in Thiel, too, in discussing overbreadth doctrine. You balance the compelling state interests involved, which is the statute's plainly legitimate sweep, the compelling interest of protecting children from what matters that are obscene as to children, against whatever infringements there are on a defendant's constitutional right. And unless it can be said that that statute criminalizes an intolerable range of criminal conduct, of constitutional conduct, it is valid. Because, after all, as the United States Supreme Court said in Broderick v. Oklahoma, overbreath is strong medicine and it is to be used sparingly as a last resort. And that is because we're basically arguing hypotheticals here. Because it's not a facial challenge, we're arguing hypotheticals. It could be applied in such an unjust situation. It may or may not have been here. And so you have to be very careful in applying this doctrine. And the fact that there may be situations on the outer fringe of the statute that might create some constitutional questions, doesn't render the statute unconstitutional so long as its broadly, plainly legitimate sweep is valid. And I would suggest that when you're dealing with 3-year-olds, 8-year-olds, 11-year-olds, 12-year-olds, or even 15-year-olds, as Mr. Trzynski did here, whether or not a 17-year-old might create a difficult situation, the fact is the plainly legitimate sweep of the statute is broad, and it promotes the compelling state interest of the state to protect the physical and psychological well-being of its children. And I don't think it serves any purpose to belittle a statute that has as its primary purpose to prevent adults from showing harmful materials to children of whatever age. And certainly if this statute were written to deal with prepubescent children, well, according to counsel's argument, it still would be invalid because it doesn't put the burden of the proof on the state to show the age of that defendant knew the age of the child. So the logical extent of his facial challenge is that even if the statute stopped at age 12, it would be invalid under the First Amendment. And I just don't think that's reasonable, and I just think that violates the principles governing review of an overbreadth challenge.
You think that in reviewing for overbreadth, the concept that scienter be a burden of the state is unreasonable?
The concept of?
Of that scienter should be a burden of the state rather than an affirmative defense. That's the problem here, isn't it? Or so alleged.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly, in Widener and Zarnke, this court concluded that the burden had to be on the state because the defendant was not in a position to reasonably ascertain the age of the child. And that's the same situation in the excitement video case in the U.S. Supreme Court. But it is reasonable for a legislature to impose a burden on the defendant to make an effort to ascertain age when he has face-to-face contact with that child. That's what the Court of Appeals said in Kevin L.C. That was the upshot of the Supreme Court's decision in excitement video, especially footnotes 2 and 5 of that decision. And that's the upshot of the discussion in this Court's decisions in Zarnke and Widener, that the scienter should not be borne by the defendant when he has no ability to ascertain the child's age. But it can be borne by the defendant when he does have the ability to ascertain age. And if he makes no effort to ascertain age, he can be penalized. But to protect the defendant, the legislature here gave him the affirmative defense to show that he made reasonable efforts to ascertain age. And, you know, in dealing with the overbreadth challenge, how burdensome is this statute on defendants? If I want to show a naked photo of myself to a stranger in a convenience store who looks like 17, 18, 19, I might want to ask her, how old are you?
Well, let's talk about that for a moment. Now, suppose it's not going to be a picture of you, but it's going to be a photograph of a nude, but it's a work of art. Only the nude, and black background, white background, just the nude. It's either a photograph that's been in a museum or could be a statue.
Well, that would be, Michelangelo's David.
Okay.
And
you can pick anything you want.
But that, first of all, that would not, I wouldn't be able to charge that because that, I couldn't prove the elements of the statute since it lacks.
The district attorney doesn't recognize it for what it is. In fact, maybe even the defendant doesn't know that it is an artistic work. He or she found it. Thinks it's nice or interesting or what have you, and now has been charged. So the judge reads the same colloquy as here and says that you transferred material to a child, that you had the knowledge of the nature of the material. The material was harmful material. That being a picture of depicting nudity of a man. You understand all these elements? And he responds, yes, I do. And by child, a child is referencing someone who has not yet reached the age of 18. You understand that's what's meant by a child? And the defendant says, yes, I do. And then goes on to the rest of the elements. Now, if the jury instructions carefully say, harmful to a child, to children, means representation of nudity when it appeals to the prurient interest is patently offensive to prevailing standards in the adult community as a whole. 3, lacks serious literary, artistic, political, scientific, or educational value for children when taken as a whole. So that would be a possible defense here. Just because it's artistic doesn't mean that it might not be a violation of the statute. It has to lack artistic value for children, when taken as a whole. So, you think that would be, the situation was an artistic photo. The same facts as this case, you think that this plea should be withdrawn or not withdrawn?
Okay, well, I'm a little confused here. Are we talking about whether the statute is constitutional?
No, I've moved to the other one,
okay.
To the other issue.
Because I think the artistic, the Miller test protects you in that situation under the constitutional challenge. As far as the guilty plea challenge, you know, if he had showed her Michelangelo's David, I think everyone would be on notice that we might want to be a little more careful here. And that the defense attorney presumably would have discussed this with him. You know, this is a famous work of art. How can they even charge this? But they have. We've got a really good defense. Let's go to trial. You know, I mean, at some point, the defense attorney has to do something. And I'm really troubled with the challenge here. Basically, counsel is saying the trial counsel did absolutely nothing. He discussed nothing with this defendant, even though he had this possible defense that this was not appealing to the prurient interest and it may have been a work of art or something. Well, if the attorney did nothing, then the attorney's ineffective. I'm sorry, that's deficient performance. And I don't know what the judge can do to cure that if he doesn't know that at the plea hearing. And when the plea colloquy and the plea form say that the attorney and the defendant have had an opportunity to discuss all these matters, and the defendant is satisfied with the representation he has obtained from counsel, I think the judge should be able to rely on that, and I think Bangert says that the judge should be able to rely on that. And so I think that should we have defined for him in the plea colloquy what nudity is? Should we have defined for him what transferred is? I mean, how does the judge know what his defenses are? In the Michelangelo situation, I think most reasonable people would say, you know, there might be a pretty good defense here. Maybe we should discuss this a little more thoroughly. You know, why is it that you're pleading guilty? Well, Your Honor, I know I have a good defense here, but I just want to get this matter over with, and I'm facing 2 counts, and I want one of them dismissed, because the one involving the 15-year-old is going to be really hard for me to win. But, you know...
I'm going to give you another statute. I mean, you're Michelangelo, you're expecting everybody to recognize. There's a statute in the Department of Justice that came into play recently, and it's of a woman representing justice. And one breast is fully exposed, I gather. I mean, I only saw it in the paper, but it was covered at that time because it was offensive to some. It's been there since the 30s, I think. So, suppose I take a photograph of that statue of justice with a breast exposed, which is nudity, and give that to a 17-year-old. Just same exact facts as here. But the lawyer doesn't recognize it. Frankly, I've been in the building. I didn't recognize it when I saw it in the newspaper. I don't know that the judge would have recognized it yet. It's a well-accepted piece of art in D.C. And now we've got a charge. No one knows it. We have exactly the same colloquy. And the guy wants to now withdraw his plea because he didn't realize he had this defense. Shall we let him withdraw the plea?
No, because he told the judge he understood that this was harmful. And he waived on the plea form and at the plea hearing all defenses, his right to have a jury trial on these issues, his right to testify about what he honestly believed. And he said, I transferred this material to a child, I knew it was harmful, and I did it anyways. And that's what he admitted. Now, if he wants to defend on the basis, you know, this really isn't harmful and this could be art, well, that's something that he and his lawyer have to decide before deciding to plead guilty. And you know, in fact, I think it reminds me of the plea hearing or the post-conviction motion hearing. You know, the counsel says that they didn't discuss any of this, and there's, you know, he was thoroughly confused, and I hope I can find it here. He was asked, Mr. Trzcinski was asked, did you understand at the time that you signed that form, that those were the matters you were admitting, that those were the elements of the offense? I understood that they were the elements. And that's at page 5. And then later on, at page 6, and did you and your attorney ever discuss whether a mere picture of a nude was harmful to children? Well, the answer is a little odd, because first of all, he says no. But then in the next sentence, he said, I recall it being discussed that it wasn't considered harmful material because it wasn't erect and I was not touching myself. You talked about that with Mr. Hayes, that's counsel. Yes, I did. And his explanation to you was that you have to be erect or touching yourself in order for it to be harmful? Answer, if I recall, his explanation was, I can't believe they ever got it in court. I talked to other attorneys in other counties, and they could not see any point in this. Okay. Sounds to me like that's discussing the nature of the materials, the nature of the possible defenses, and then for whatever reason, making a strategic decision to plead guilty.
Mr. Bryan, let me put it in the I thought, relatively understandable terms of Mr. Fullen. Where in the record can you show... Well, he says that the standard is, he didn't know he could ask a jury to determine if the jury thought that these materials were harmful to Jill, the 17-year-old. Where can you point out that he knew he could ask a jury to determine if these materials were harmful to this particular person?
So now we're talking about the reasonable minor of like age standard and feel? Yeah, Well, and of course, that's interesting because that's not even in the statute or in the jury instruction, the reasonable minor of like.
I'm not asking,
and I don't know if there is anything in the record. I mean, other than that, this discussion here, where he said they discussed the fact that, you know, that he was not in a state of sexual excitement, that he thought it was art, and that he and his attorney discussed
it. Let me ask it another way. What if he went to trial and he proved that these materials were not harmful to Jill. Is that an acquittal?
Sure. Because, well, the state has the burden of proving that they are harmful. So whether the state failed its burden or he affirmatively proved that they were not, yeah, the jury has to find him not guilty.
So would you agree then with Mr. Fullan's statement that he had to know that he could ask a jury to determine if these materials were harmful to Jill? I'm not talking about a reasonable person standard. I'm talking about Jill, the 17-year-old.
Well, no, I think that the standard in Thiel is a reasonable minor of like age. It's not Jill. It's a reasonable minor of like age.
Right, it's an objective test. It's
yes.
Not a subjective test.
Yes.
And if Jill had taken the witness stand and said, you know, these pictures didn't bother me.
Right.
That's not...
Well, a 12-year-old could take the stand and say, these pictures didn't bother me. But I think you could also say a reasonable minor of 12-year-olds might
have
been offended.
Right, it's an objective test for the jury to apply.
Right.
But you're right to suggest or to say that that language from Thiel about how the jury makes that determination is not in the standard jury instruction. It would have had to have been requested and added based upon the facts of this case.
Well, and I
so
guess
attaching, merely attaching the jury instructions or having the judge...
The jury instruction wouldn't have helped there. I mean, and I don't see anything in counsel's briefs discussing that aspect of it. He said that you needed to define, you needed to include the definition of harmful to children as well in discussing the element of harmful materials, but there's no separate request that you also discuss the reasonable minor of like age standard in Thiel. And of course, I would think that that might be pretty significant in this case, and it might be a good idea to do that. But I guess that just begs the question, how far do we go here? And I think what Banger does is it gives us a limit, the minimal standard that a judge at least has to follow. That the judge has to ascertain the understanding of the elements. You can, and their way, and Bangert at pages 267 and 68 talk about the different ways of doing it. You can refer to the statute. You can refer to the jury instructions. And that's another thing. If you look at the jury instructions, which is 2142, I believe, and that instruction lists three elements. And I'll quote the instruction. The first element requires that the defendant exhibited, transferred, etc., harmful material to a child. Next page. The second element requires that the defendant had knowledge of the nature of the material. The third element requires that the child had not attained the age of 18. So even if you follow the jury instructions, now I understand the jury instructions also contain the definition of harmful materials, and that's fine. But if we're, but what Banger says, you got to at least ask the defendant, did he list the elements and ask him, do you understand each of those elements? Yes, I do. That's the minimal inquiry that Banger requires. Now, a particular case may require more. A defense attorney might tell a court judge, we're really having problems here, but my client wants to plead guilty. You better go through this real thoroughly, or you may have an Alford plea situation where you need to be, you know, the cases require a lot more specificity. And so, you know, but again, the three elements were discussed.
Counsel, here's my problem, and I don't know if as a judge this should enter into a decision, okay, that I've got to make when I vote on this case. I think all the judge here did touch the base on all the elements. I think that the plea waiver agreement said he understood. He might have understood, he might not, but he said he did. There'll be evidence in the transcript that he understood. There'll be evidence that he didn't understand. I'm assuming that. And now, here's what I'm not sure I can consider as a judge. As a judge, I think he may have had a good defense. The jury might have accepted that this wasn't harmful to a reasonable, objective 17-year-old. And the jury might have said, heck, it was harmful. The jury might have said to itself, as any judge says, it's a little odd running around showing nude pictures of yourself to community people. Some people might think it's a little odd showing nude photos of yourself in Playgirl or Playboy or something else that goes to hundreds of thousands of people. But that's not a violation of the law necessarily. So we can't have a moralistic subjective view of whether his conduct is right. So I have, let me say, that suppose I as a judge have doubts about whether he would be convicted. And he is now sitting in prison, right? 6 years. 6 years when he might have been convicted, he did not. But all the bases might very well have been touched. Do I close my eyes as a judge to the possibility that he had a really good defense? Or do I say, tough luck, sit there for 6 years in an overcrowded prison and what does it cost now, 25 grand a year? 25 or 30 times 6. Now, you know, as a mother of a former 17-year-old, in whatever my views about the morals here are sort of irrelevant as a judge, but my concepts of whether or not there's a defense here that he didn't use are there. Can I consider that, or is that just gone? That I'd really be disobeying the law as a judge if I put that into the equation. Is there any room for that?
You'd be disobeying the law if you do what?
If I considered the fact that on this record it appears that he has a good defense and a jury might have acquitted.
Counsel, can I add to that? Excuse me, Chief Justice.
Sorry.
Add to that, the judge is sitting there knowing, and this is why I asked this of your opposing counsel, that the state had agreed to dismiss this count one, which we refer to on page 3, with the 15-year-old, but that was read into the record for the purpose of sentencing. In other words,
yeah, counsel said that's irrelevant. Yeah. It's not irrelevant. Yeah. It was an essential part of the plea bargain.
Yeah, well, I just wanted to say, counsel said that's irrelevant.
That was an essential part of the plea bargain.
Yeah.
It was read into the, and it helped enhance the sentence.
And
his business of 6 years, he faced 16.
Right, and as a trial judge, that certainly was involved in this situation.
At the outset of the plea agreement.
And one other question. Would he have, let's say, if this is kicked, then it goes back and it's the 15-year-old, I mean, the trial would not have taken place just on the issue we're dealing with. It would have failed on count one also.
Right. He would face trial on both counts.
I think we have, we have a case that says that, right? Okay, and I put that in. My question is still the same.
But, you know, should the judge have taken into account, well, you know, again.
Should this court, in reviewing this case, take that into account?
No, because he and his attorney, people plead guilty all the time for a variety of different reasons, and they regularly waive very strong defenses. Because there are benefits to pleading guilty. You don't always plead guilty because you're guilty. The Alford case proves that. And so I don't think it necessarily, and again, is it advisable to judges for judges to do that, especially in a case like this where you have a 17-year-old? Sure, it's advisable to do it. Should it be made mandatory? No, because where do you stop? Anytime you have a technical element with a specific definition, you're going to require judges in the plea colloquy to read the counsel even admit the judge did the proper rote recitation, and the rote recitation was done here. He could have done more, yes. He didn't have to under Banker. And whether this man had a, you know, whether you have a valid defense and whether you should take it to trial, those are strategic matters that the defense attorney and the defendant discuss before they come into the court and say, Judge, we're going to plead guilty here. And we're going to do it, and I don't think it is proper for the court to say, why are you pleading guilty? You know, what are your strategic reasons? You know, is it because the state's going to drop that other count, or is it because you're really guilty, or is it because you don't think you have a defense? I don't think those are relevant considerations for a judge, and I don't think the Bangor requires that.
Counsel, Justice Brasson.
Yes.
The defendant gave a 17-year-old nude pictures of himself. Suppose he had invited that 17-year-old out on a date, and they had had intercourse with her consent. Is that a criminal offense?
Boy, that's that gray area where you're dealing with 16, 18. I think it is a misdemeanor. I believe it's a misdemeanor. Yes. If I recall correctly, I believe that someone between the ages, someone who is 16 or 17, that if you have sexual intercourse, it's a misdemeanor, even with consent. With consent. Without consent, obviously, it's a much greater offense. Yes, and that's strict liability. There's no affirmative defense there. Here, again, dealing with this
Should consent enter into this at all in a situation where she really initiated contact with him by saying, well, congratulations, your pictures are going to be in Playgirl.
Well, I don't know that means that you consent to have him display the phone. And it does, you know, if she were 12 and said the same thing, no, consent is irrelevant here, and regardless of the age of the child.
I have one final question on the constitutional attack on the statute. The defense argues that the statute is unconstitutional because it does not require that the state prove the age of the child or the fact that the child was underage. Hasn't the statute been amended since our decision in the Widener case to require proof of the child's, or to prove that the defendant knew that the child was underage?
Well, at least in that context of where the defendant is unable to ascertain the age of the child. But I think that it still, that the original intent of the statute was not to put the burden on the state to prove the age of the child. That's what this court said in Czarnecki and Widener. And so the legislature had to do that in that situation where the defendant did not have face-to-face contact. But consistent with the intent of the legislature, in this situation where the defendant is able to reasonably ascertain age because of face-to-face contact, the statute is still does not require the state to prove scienter. And I don't think that change, legislative change, affected this sort of situation, the face-to-face situation. And so if he wants to prove a reasonable mistake as to age, he has to invoke the affirmative defense at trial. I see my red light is on. So.
Thank you. Mr. O'Brien. Mr. Fullen, you have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
If I said that the dismissal and read-in was irrelevant, that isn't correct. It's relevant to the sentence. It's not relevant to whether a valid plea was entered. It's not relevant to the constitutionality of the statute, but it is relevant to the 6 years that he got. Mr. O'Brien has cited a case from the Fifth Circuit, United States against Fox. It's 248 Fed Third 394. That case came down 4 months before this court granted review in this case, and might profitably have been included in Mr. O'Brien's brief. If you go to it and read it, as I did after he notified me by fax yesterday, you will see that the government in that case the court noted that the government must prove in each instance that the defendant knowingly received sexually explicit depictions of minors or those who appear to be minors. The statute has a scienter requirement which applies to the age of the persons depicted as well as to the nature of the materials. And it comments more about that, but I think that it's easily distinguishable from what we're talking about.
Counsel, why isn't this an ineffective assistance of counsel?
Well, you're an appellate attorney, you get a file, you read it. I thought the plea colloquy was not very detailed. I thought the plea questionnaire was not very detailed. I went and met with my client, and we talked about, you know, where to go with it, and we did what we did. And there were other issues that we could have raised. Maybe in hindsight, I lose this. Next time I'll call the man ineffective or not. But, you know, I first have to prove that a reasonable lawyer would have, you know, discussed the definition of this offense more than this one did. I probably could have shown that. But then I would have to show that it made a difference in this case, you know, and I guess I could, you know, put the client on the stand saying I would never have pled if I'd understood this. Maybe I could have won it that way. I make a call. You know, maybe I could have attacked the sentence, you know, which I think, personally, is the worst thing about this case.
Well, I sit here and I think, why isn't this on the facts that we know, why isn't this an excessive sentence argument? Or on the facts that we know, why isn't this an ineffective assistance of counsel? One that concerns me. Well, your opposing counsel suggests that, you know, reasons of strategy.
Well, that's true. I mean, I didn't even really consider it. I go, well, I did talk to the lawyer, and he confirmed to me, this is out of the record, maybe I shouldn't talk about it, but he didn't go over the definition of harmful to minors with the client. I should have alleged he was ineffective. Pardon?
On the sentence of justice that had been raised 6 years. Was a repeater in here?
Yeah, it was a repeater. He could have got the same 6 without the second count.
The other offenses were not of the same nature as this
one. No, there was one that was way out in left field that I pursued. I got extensions and I sent an investigator, but I couldn't prove it, so I dropped that one. So an appellate lawyer has to make some choices, and maybe I made a poor one here. And I'm not trying to put this all on Judge Murrah. I think that, you know, a guy should know what he's pleading to, and, you know, partly it was the judge, but partly it was the lawyer's job to tell him, and, you know, maybe I should have thrown that claim in, and maybe next time I will. I don't like to do it. I don't like to call people ineffective, but I'm not afraid to do it. It's a big hassle. You got to make sure they're there. You got to subpoena them. You got to prepare. You got to prove the two prongs. It's very, very difficult to win an ineffective.
How many times do counsel win on an effective assistance of counsel?
How many times?
And you prevail on that.
Oh, well, it's hard. You know, I don't think I ever have exactly on that theory. I got a reversal based on interest of justice when there was also an ineffective claim in there. But, you know, because I think judges don't like to call local counsel ineffective. You know, they if they're going to give you relief, they'll do it under interest of justice because I don't like it, you know. But I'm not saying it couldn't have been pursued. It could. I guess.
We do it on the interest of justice here, counsel.
I suppose. Let's see. Interest of justice, you got to show that the jury heard something it shouldn't or didn't hear something it should, and there wasn't any jury. So does he get to withdraw his plea in the interest of justice? I'll take it if that's what you want to write, you know. Is the statute
unconstitutional
in the interest of justice? I don't think so, you know. I mean, that one didn't occur to me, but I almost always add that claim when I have an ineffective. And I would also ask you to look at the last two paragraphs of Widener. I don't know whether the legislature has fixed this statute. Widener says it fixed the Czarnecki statute. I would be surprised, but I would be happy to supply that information. It's factual information within the next week.
But we can look that up, can't we, ourselves?
Yeah, you could. Yeah, right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fullen. Thank you, Mr. O'Brien. That concludes our hearing on 00-2545-CR State v. Trichinsky. And the court's in recess.